So it is February 27th, 2009. I am Marcy Korb, M-A-R-C-I-K-O-R-B, and my interviewee is Sarah Harder, S-A-R-A-H-H-A-R-D-E-R. We're at her apartment in Eau Claire, and it is 10:45. Okay, I'd like to begin, I'm just going to ask you some basic background questions. So, what was the date and place of your birth?
September 9th, 1937, Chicago, Illinois. Oh, right. At John B. Murphy Hospital, August Stroke, the doctor.
I'm September 19th, so
really?
We're close.
Great.
Yeah. What is your ancestry, your ethnicity?
Total Irish on one side and total Swedish on the other.
How many male or female siblings do you have?
No males, one female.
One sister.
Mm-hmm.
What's the birth order in your family?
I'm first. She's 2 years younger.
Okay. What is the name and occupation of your previous partner or spouses? Or?
Two of them. I married Richard Cass in 1958 in Crystal Lake, Illinois, which was very close to my then home, Cary, Illinois. And he was at that time a salesman for prescription drugs. And so, and from there we moved to La Crosse, Wisconsin, where we had two kids, and then I was divorced. I divorced him, I believe, in 1961. And then my second husband is Harry Harder, a retired professor from UW-Eau Claire, whom I met and married at Bowling Green State University, where I started a master's degree at the same time he was starting a PhD. And we married in, I went there in the fall of 1963. We were married in February 1964. He adopted my two sons, Richard and Bentley. And then we had a daughter, Jennifer, in 1964, and a son, Aaron, in 1971. And we were divorced in 1997.
So you have four children,
mm-hmm.
three boys and a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How many, do you have any grandchildren?
11.
11 grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
How many boys or girls?
Well, the boys are ahead now. It's wonderful. The girls started strong. But it's six boys and five girls. But all of a sudden we have a whole string of little boys, five and under, that I'm just thrilled with because, of course, I was a mother with a lot of boys. But I'm also very glad to have the girls.
Yeah. Is there anything about your general background that you think would be important to include?
I don't know what kind of question that is.
Okay. It'll go on. There's more stories mm-hmm. from childhood and adolescence, mm-hmm. so it'll kind of include that. Describe your relationship with your parents and siblings when you were growing up.
Well, I was the troublemaker in the family, and my relationship with my parents perhaps can be best described by a comment made by my Aunt Lou, my mother's slightly older sister, when she came to our home, and I was 2 years old, and I was in the bedroom with the door closed, screaming at the top of my lungs. Aunt Lou said, aren't you afraid that you're going to break her spirit? And to which my father responded without missing a beat, no, but she's sure likely to break ours. So my relationship with my parents was stormy. I was always way too outspoken and could be counted on to say or do nothing bad, but sort of always the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult because I had a sister, Susan, 2 years younger, who was not only beautiful, but sweetness and light. She was smart enough to watch all the things I did and not do them herself. And I ended up being the one who got spanked, and in some cases more than spanked by my father. And sort of At the same time, they were terribly proud of me because I did stuff. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing is that as time went on, they came to really, really, I think, be proud. They were proud. They were terribly upset when I first was divorced. It was at a time when women didn't go walk away from marriages for, quote, no reason. Mm-hmm. And and my father particularly, who was not Catholic, he was the Swedish part of the family, and but he had signed this contract when they were married, in order to be married to a Catholic woman. He had signed the contract saying, of course, everybody would be raised Catholic, which we were, more or less. But I think partly for me, he was crying, but I'd never seen him cry, but my mother said he cried and cried when he heard I was divorced. On the other hand, they were the ones who, when I did not receive the child support I was awarded, gave me their support instead, which allowed me to go to UW and to what was then La Crosse State College at $60 a semester. And it was what I got from them was $250 a month, and that was what the two boys and I lived on until I graduated. And once I graduated and then went to graduate school, I mean, their minds were blown. I always remember my father, who owned a hardware store and was a very practical man, saying to me, after I got my master's degree and after we got the job at Eau Claire, I did my thesis on Shakespeare, and I really did think for a while that I would be a Shakespearean scholar. I was so into it, and I'd done my master's degree on Henry V, and I presented it as an anti-war play at a time that was not thought of at all, but I did it partly by looking at historical sources and partly by looking at the structure of the play and the prologues that undercut, ironically, you know, what was going on afterwards. So I really thought, okay. But on the other hand, I didn't go ahead and get the PhD, so it was, it's not in the cards. But my father said one time he was visiting, and Harry, of course, was a Shakespearean scholar too, so he said, you know, this guy's Shakespeare, I've been thinking about this. How many people over these centuries do you suppose have built their career on Shakespeare and made money from this guy? He said, it's just an idea. You might want to pursue it. So we became, we did love one another. It's just that we had a very stormy relationship. And another thing, I think that when they retired from a hardware store in Cary, Illinois, they moved to a small farm in Stanley, Wisconsin. They didn't farm it, but they did. They lived close enough to us to see grandchildren and so forth. But in any case, we were out, all of us, grandchildren and all, planting pine trees from the DNR to sort of reclaim some of this land. And my father always had a very particular way of doing everything. And he would put in a shovel on one side and a shovel on the other, pick up the piece and stick in the thing and put it back. I stuck in the shovel on one side, pushed it forwards, put in the pine. He said, Sarah, you really need to do it this way. And I said, look, we'll look in a year. We'll look in a year and see how they've grown. He said, okay. So it was sort of I used to get smacked in the face for making comments like that. But this time he showed me that he really, really did appreciate me. Mm-hmm. My mother was a ballerina initially. She didn't graduate from college. She didn't go to college. She went immediately from high school into the ballet. And actually then turned to running a ballet school in Chicago. And my father, and she was very, very good at it. She won an award at the World's Fair of 1934. I think that's when it was. Maybe it was 33, for the best children's production in the fair, with her production of Hansel and Gretel. And my father really helped with that. I mean, they met during the Depression. They were married for 3 years secretly before they got married publicly. And I think my Irish Catholic grandmother was infuriated to find out at one point later, I think it was 10 years later, she found out they'd been married before, and her response was, I'm going to tell your sister! but in any case, it was because my grandparents on the Irish side had been quite well-to-do. My grandfather was a politician, superintendent of streets when he died at a very early age, I think 50, and to just all kinds of accolades for the work he had done. My grandmother then turned to drinking. They had a lovely home in the city and a wonderful home in the country, which we finally moved to, and where those pictures you see of me climbing, you know, that was my freedom. Mm-hmm. My mother was a truly amazing person. She went on after we moved to the country, which took her away from her dancing school, and the dancing school she'd very well established, and you know all what she'd known. When we moved to the country, she started as an impresario to travel around to schools, high schools, and so forth, and put on performances, mostly of operettas, Victor Herbert operettas, or things like Hansel and Gretel, kind of things for kids. And so she continued, you know, to really be a somebody who just went out as a fairly shy person, just went out and started a great books course in Cary, Illinois, you know, became a great books instructor. She's a woman who read more than I will ever think of reading. I mean, just loved Euclid's Geometry and, I mean, all of the classics, and read them and talked about them. So she was somebody who always, both of them always pushed education. Mm-hmm. We had to get education. That it was going to be the ticket for the future.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about your community, and your dad was worked at a hardware store, owned a hardware store.
He started by working there and then owned it, yep.
Who had the power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect your family, if it's relevant?
Well, it's interesting that we lived in Chicago until 1946. In 1946, at the end of the war, we moved to Cary, Illinois, which was 40 miles out of Chicago, anticipating by a couple of decades it used to be what we called going to the country, because the ride, you know, had nothing in between Chicago and this little town. But we lived in a place actually between two small towns on the Fox River. The other town was Algonquin, where we actually first went to school. My mother had, to a certain extent, because of her family background and her professional work, which was still very much respected in the family, she had a very respected position. My father gained one. He, during the war, worked in Chicago, worked for what was called George Murphy's serving tray company or something, and they made, because there was no metal, they made wooden serving trays with glass tops and pictures underneath. And as you can imagine, as soon as metal was available, they didn't end up being very popular. But the other thing that made him, he quit his job, actually, as manager of the company, because they were going to be unionized. And he and my mother were fiercely Republican, fiercely, fiercely, fiercely so. So he then, you know, we had received permission from my grandmother to move into this wonderful house on the river that is this one, that had been abandoned basically after my grandfather died in the 20s, except for weekends and things like that. It had been a great flourishing place where all of their four children brought their friends. But it was, as you can see, a perfectly beautiful place, which by that time had become pretty wild. So we, you know, sort of reclaimed it. But my father started in a job managing a hardware store, not something he'd ever done before. But a couple of years later, my grandmother died, and we had all the four children had some inheritance, and so they invested their money in the hardware store and bought it. And at that point, I mean, if you look at the things for Cary Hardware, they say Cary Hardware Company, not incorporated, Frank W. Snell owner. My mother always worked at the hardware store too. She did the accounts, and it was something, you know, she learned to do and did very, very well. But her visibility was in work in the community that was, you know, just unpaid work, where she was putting up. After we get done with tapes, I'll show you some pictures of some of the extravaganzas that she created. We were sometimes involved, but often, you know, often not. We would come, you know, we would go as spectators to the events that she created. My father became involved in the Lions Club in Cary, which was a nothing organization when he joined it, and became very, very big. I mean, he was a great community supporter, great community activist, and so in town, they were both known because they both worked in the hardware store. And when I was 12, I started working in the hardware store. But I think there's no question that he, you know, he was the head of the household, even though, and as a matter of fact, although he had very early in their relationship tremendously supported my mother's intellectual interest by giving her a very large set of art books and a very large set of other kinds of literary works, he didn't really like her talking about it, and I think Susan and I could both say, "Shut up, Mag," was something that we heard often, and, you know, just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, moving on from that, what role did education play in your life, throughout high school or throughout college?
Well, I was... In kindergarten in a Chicago public school, I was the teacher's pet. She really... I had graham crackers with her every day during milk break, and the other kids didn't. I let her down terribly, however, in one of the first school performances, where when I saw my mother in the audience, I broke down in tears and had to go sit with my mother, and the other kids sang the song. But she still, I mean, she really did dote. I mean, she gave me a lot of support. She pushed me to do some things. In first grade, I was a star. I wrote some stories for the newspaper, which I think I still got copies of. One day I had a ball and it rolled away. I cried all that day, something like that. You know, we had a little school newspaper and they got things. I got things published that I wrote. And I got to be Mother Goose in the first grade play. It has been a long time since I have seen all my storybook friends. I think I will have a party and invite them all to come, is all I remember of it, but that's it. When we went, so I was pretty good. Interestingly, both my parents had graduated from Brentano School, because in those days, Chicago was a city that was a collection of small towns, you know, the neighborhoods, and we lived in Logan Square. They had both graduated from that school, and my grandfather, the one who became the the good politician, had also graduated from that same grammar school. I was going during the war years, and it became a kind of community center, as it had been, I think, in my mother's youth, where things were going on all the time, and scrap drives and stamp drives and things like that, and I did quite well there. I guess I was promoted. I skipped to 2B and moved to 2A or something like that. But then we moved out to this much smaller school. It, on the one hand, it was moving from Chicago was just like being set free, because my mother kept us on a very short leash, and I will tell you, it was white glove era. We wore white gloves, I think, partly so we wouldn't, you know, if we touched things, they wouldn't get, you know, our hands wouldn't get dirty or something. But also, it was beginning to be a frightening place. It was a terribly, terribly traumatizing kidnapping and dismemberment of a child who was the same age as my sister, kidnapping from her room, and I by this time was an avid reader of the Chicago Daily News, so I read all of this stuff. So I was really afraid in Chicago, and even though I walked many blocks to school every day, and the other thing was that at that time I had relatives all over this little community, you know, aunts and grandmother and cousins and so forth, who lived all around this Logan Square area. But still, it wasn't a place that I felt safe in. I actually was, I guess we would call it today, sexually assaulted. In a park when I was about 8 years old, when I took the kids of my mother's accompanist to the park and was with them, and a man fondled me. I mean, it was enough to make my mother say, "Whoa, this is not the friendly place we thought it was." So I think they saw, for many reasons, the idea of moving to the country gave us a great new opportunity. But for me, the move to this school where I had to make friends cold was not easy. Mm-hmm. I never was particularly good at making friends. Susan was always good at making mm-hmm. friends. And so I really felt kind of out of it there for the first year. And the second year, when I was in fifth grade, it was my year of trauma, where I was always bursting into tears. And the teacher was very... I was lucky to have very good teachers there. In sixth grade, Mother did the operetta Hansel and Gretel with the Algonquin grade school, third to sixth graders. And I wanted desperately to be Gretel, and I had gone around singing all these Humperdinck songs, you know, for weeks beforehand to prove that my not very good voice could manage this thing. And I remember when my beloved teacher, Miss Freeman, made the announcement that she said, "Gretel will be Gwen and Sarah will be the witch." So I was the witch. And I was an extraordinary witch, Mother tells me. Children were crying all over the auditorium. But of course, it's sort of fixes in your mind. I mean, it was a much better role for me, and I now see, of course, it was a much meatier role, but it was not... I think what I always wanted to be was kind of more normal than I was. I was also, however, that was my phase of believing I was never going to really grow up to be a woman. I was a boy, and I would grow up to be a girl. If you look at some of these pictures, and you'll see I always wore dresses because Mother made most of them beautifully. But pants, which we would never wear to school, were what I went into immediately upon going home. And the best day of my life was when I walked into a local drugstore in Cary, and I had asked for a boy's cap for Christmas with earmuffs, and I had it, turned around and walked out, and I heard Dave, the druggist, say to his friend, "You know, some of these kids, if you didn't see the braids hanging down their back, you'd think they were a boy." I've done it. Anyway, I did okay in school. It was understood that I was smart. I remember one time saying to a teacher, "You always ask Tony Picorni the questions. Why was it? Why was that the case? I had my hand up too, and you never asked me," mm-hmm. and I knew the answer. But I was... It was just a really tough time there. Then we moved out of my dream home, and after 3 years, and into Cary, the small town. So it was another change into seventh grade in a very small school where we had 11 kids in my class, and so we were combined with the eighth grade. And again, another adjustment at a time when I was feeling more and more out of it. Again, academically did very well. I hated my braids, and finally, I guess about halfway through seventh grade, Mother agreed to cut them into short braids, which was my first step. I'd spent my life eating crusts of bread and drinking all my milk because it was promised that would turn my hair curly. And as you can see, it never did. In any case... I had some very good girlfriends, but I clearly was not making it with the boys, who would, you know, make snide remarks. And I, perhaps one of my memories is eighth grade graduation, when each of us, because there were only 11 of us, got to tell what we saw ourselves doing in the future. And I got up and announced that I thought that I would be the curator of butterflies at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, at which point the audience dissolved in laughter, which meant I never for a moment again took that seriously.
Right.
So I'm pretty sure it wouldn't have been my thing,
right. And,
but nonetheless. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I had a lot of very good support, particularly when I was in eighth grade, by a woman teacher who replaced the man we had had when I was in seventh and really, really helped me to think ahead.
Looks like this. Sorry, it stopped recording for a second. Okay, that's good. Sorry. So looking back at your childhood.
Oh, and I'll say in high school I was also an outsider. Although I did get elected secretary of the class, and I was in plays and band and chorus, and I had a very good group of girlfriends, but I was not very good with boys. Had my first boyfriend when I was 15, and a tragic 16th birthday when he broke up with me, and you know, so that sort of thing. But an admission I'm not proud of, I followed a boy to the University of Iowa. We had in those days, what would be called a very torrid romance, which meant we went to the drive-in and kissed. And his mother became my dear, dear friend, and she had only boys, and really took to me and mentored me a lot. And even when he went away to college after our summer romance, and I decided, since it was, you know, I was applying, that I'd go ahead and apply to University of Iowa also, which my parents wondered about. But it turned out that I did get, I got a number of awards. I got into Honor Society, and I got a scholarship, and I got a number of things. I mean, it was clear I had recognition in high school, but I was never satisfied with my success as an ordinary girl. Mm. And so when I went on to college, by this time we had broken up. I was there at the University of Iowa. I decided I would try out for a sorority, which was absolutely unlike me. But suddenly became very important, and I pledged one. The one I really wanted kept me up there till the last minute, and I wasn't, you know, so I took, you know, what was my second choice. But that gave me a great, you know, I was enough serious about, I got really good grades the first semester and really bad grades the second semester because I was much more involved now in social life and so forth. They spotted me as a leader and made me the treasurer of Alpha Delta Pi, which was the worst choice they could ever have made. And finally, after, you know, I hadn't put them into bankruptcy, but it was perfectly clear with the checks piled all over my room that it was not the system they had in mind. But nonetheless, I got my first trip out to the big world, to the University of Minnesota, where we went for a sorority gathering, which had a lot of eye-opening things about it. I don't know if they're important here, but it became clear that I was not treasure material. And the other thing that was very good was that one of the sorority leaders took me aside one day and said, "Hey, listen, kid, you got to learn to control your lip." I mean, she said it with, you know, far more decorously than that. Mm-hmm. And I began to understand that there were just ways that I was shooting myself in the foot, and hurting people inadvertently, not really meaning to. So I did learn very important things there about not shooting myself in the foot and not hurting people. But that's also where I met Dick in a Spanish class. I was doing really pretty well again, but he was the just forbidden fruit. He was a beautiful man. He was 28, and I was, what, 19?
And Dick was your first husband.
My first husband, yeah. And I had, by the way, said to myself the New Year's Eve before I met him that January in a Spanish class, I think this has got to be the year that I find somebody. And to surprise, I did. And he was 28, and he was divorced, and he had a kid. I mean, what could be better for a Catholic girl rebelling in the, you know, absurdest way? But it was wonderful when I could blow out the candle, and, you know, everybody said. So I dropped out of college then, you know, sort of 2.5 years.
Your junior year.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
2.5 years into it. And then education became extraordinarily important to me. I mean, there I was in La Crosse, Wisconsin, in this little house, little apartment, with nothing to do. And so my parents kept saying, go back to school, go back to school. So I went back to school. But then I was immediately pregnant, and, you know, so I sort of piddled around. And then I was immediately pregnant again. And so I piddled through taking some courses, but I had a miscarriage, which would have been a third child, at the point, and she would have been 1 year younger than Bentley, my second child. And somehow at that point I thought, you know, this isn't working, this marriage here. I mean, we don't have anything in common. And he was a traveling salesman, so I was managing all of the house alone and doing, and I just couldn't think. And I said to myself, okay, I have just lost this girl child who I wanted very much, but I have two hands and two boys. And if I'm going to have a baby a year if I stay in this marriage, and we'll get nowhere. So I did this terrible thing about having, you know, initiating the divorce, which shocked everybody. Nobody in my family, nobody anywhere knew that this was going to happen.
Did you have girlfriends that supported you in that? Or were
I didn't have close friends.
Yeah.
And even, you know, even my sister who lived now in Minneapolis and was married also. No, everybody was just totally shocked. And I figured out I had to do it myself. I had earned $100 running a great big festival for the city, for the Chamber of Commerce, and that bought me the lawyer. And so I decided, I said, yeah, I just decided to do it. And I'd already been to school pregnant, you know, been on the campus pregnant, and so forth. People just shaking their heads, what she's doing here. But actually, the last summer that I went, the summer that I also had the miscarriage, I became fascinated with Victorian literature, really, really into the courses. And so that was when I decided, you know, to go ahead, to go back to college, get a teaching degree, and go out as a high school teacher or something, which never happened, of course.
So looking back at all of that, did you anticipate that you'd become a feminist later in life?
No. I mean, looking back on it, I can see I always was,
right,
but there was no name for it. And no, I think what happened, no, actually that didn't happen until I got here. And I think what made me understand it was when I was denied the opportunity to take sick leave when Aaron was imminent. I went to the personnel office just, you know, saying, just well in advance to say, look, I'm going to be taking 3 weeks of sick leave, you know, when my baby's born.
3 weeks. That's
3 weeks.
Barely anything,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And I had had Jennifer in graduate school, so, I mean, then I only took 4 days off. I mean, it was no big deal. So I knew I could handle it. I never, you know, I had fairly easy pregnancies, but I was told no. No, by the personnel office, a very nice woman. She said, "You just can't do it. You can't use pregnancy as the reason for sick leave." So I went to then it was Acting Chancellor Hibbard. Leonard Haas was down in Madison for the year, making the UW system, creating it, and he said, "Well, of course not." He said, "Here, I've got the policy." I think she'd probably called ahead. And he said, "I have the policy right here." And I don't remember its real words, but to me it read, "Any female person who should be sadly find herself in a condition of pregnancy would best absent herself at once from the campus so as not to taint the students, but in no case can anything related to her pregnancy be qualified as sick leave." So I lost it. And I mean, I didn't cry. I didn't, and I just said, I won't accept that. Mm-hmm. And he called Harry shortly thereafter and said, you know, your wife got a little emotional in here. Maybe we can talk man to man about this deal. And Harry is, I have to say, a feminist. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had been, and from the very beginning of our marriage, you know, deeply involved in all of this kid stuff and all of it. Anyway, he was more irate with Hibbard than I had been, and we both decided we would appeal it. Mm-hmm. Well, to make a long story short, it went on and on and on, and we even had hearings on our campus about this whole idea of getting sick, you know, pregnancy and sick leave and stuff. And it got down to the point where I was about 2 weeks from my date, and I went in and told Hibbard, I said, look, if I'm not allowed sick leave, oh, by the way, first I said, it's okay, if I don't get sick leave, then you can just pay Harry. And he said, oh, no, of course we can't do that. He's doing that coverage, you know, and that's just, and that, I mean, that was what.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said, I just want you to know that if nothing changes before I go to the hospital, I will be calling a press corps and be taken by ambulance to my classroom with the press corps on my heels in order to make my point. And suddenly things changed. And as a matter of fact, that same spring, the whole policy for the UW system changed. So I didn't do this because I was a feminist. Mm-hmm. I did it because it was just so damn stupid. Mm-hmm. And so unjust. I had never taken a day of sick leave. You know, I had sick leave up the yin-yang. Mm-hmm. But anyway, then after that happened, I understood that with timing was everything. Because, of course, it was 1971, and it was not 1961. Mm-hmm. And things were big, you know, ideas were beginning to change. And even TELF, which was then the name of the system union, faculty union, wouldn't really support me, but supported me, mm. You know. And I understood that none of this could have happened before, but with luck and timing, one could change things not only for oneself, but more importantly, for others. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the point when I still wasn't putting a name to it, but understood that I wanted to do more of this. This was really important. And it was then, I assume you probably saw that Cinderella in composition thing, yep, that I wrote in The Spectator. Mm-hmm. That was when we started the Now, you know, it was actually Gloria Steinem and Flo Kennedy came to campus in 71 while I was in the hospital having Aaron. So I didn't see them. Mm-hmm. But
I saw Gloria Steinem my freshman year.
Anyway, we decided we'd form this Now chapter, and I don't know if you know why I wrote that thing. I wrote it because we held the meeting on campus, the founding meeting, because we figured we wanted to get students involved, mm-hmm, and none came. We held it at the Davies Center. We publicized it widely, and none came. And so I was, you know, standing around there figuring out what's the deal here. Everybody was, you know, where are they? What's going on? And that next, I had this assignment that I gave my composition students, and this girl wrote her essay, mm-hmm, and suddenly, bango, you know, I understood. It was still the same as it was when I blew out the candle, yeah, 'cause so I could be one of the gang. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's when the light went off. And, of course, you know, then it's a whole bunch of things that had to do with luck. I mean, it had to do with then this article, my friend Eleanor Jones saying, this is really good, you ought to send it into Red Book, and then it getting published in Red Book, which, because of the times, you know, there were no National Enquirers or any of those things on newsstands, mm-hmm, in those days, and Red Book decided it was going to publicize this. So all of a sudden, one day, I see this ad on TV. You know, local faculty member, or I don't know if they called me, local divorcee tells all or something. I don't know. You know, yeah, something, you know. Just imagine somebody who not only says she got divorced, but says it was a good thing, you know. And so that gave me all kinds of notoriety. I'm absolutely convinced it's one of the reasons that John Morris, you know, started asking me, you know, about this affirmative action mm-hmm. position. Suddenly I was getting speaking requests, you know, at and I was being, I was at that point, I don't know if I was a member of AAUW, American Association of University Women, but the woman who, a woman named Hilda Carter, who was our public relations person at the university, had been the corporate rep for AAUW, and she's the one who told me I needed to become a member of this organization and started telling me about it. And it wasn't until 1977 that they had a meeting that I could go to. And, by the way, giving Dina St. Louis enormous credit, while she was still affirmative action officer, she gave me money to go to something called the Emerging Woman in Management in Chicago. First time I'd ever gone to a seminar. First time I flew. I had acrophobia big time. And I just didn't and wouldn't. And my friends told me, go, just don't sweat it. And one said to me, oh, you know, just all you have to do is just look at the ground when you're going up. You'll know everything will be fine. And it was. I fainted. And, you know, I then, but on the other hand, I understood through this management thing, you know, which didn't tell me anything I didn't know, but suddenly put a construct on it that let me understand that there were things to be learned about it and so forth. You know, there's a theory, there mm-hmm. are practices, you know, all of this other stuff. So that was, and then finally when I did go to that first AAUW meeting convention, I was involved in my local branch. I ran the programs for AAUW for 2 years out of my office. And that 1977 was definitely the pivotal year when first the AAUW convention in Minnesota, I saw all of the feminism that we were espousing in now, but an order, you know, that, you know, a meeting being run with people debating and, you know, all kinds of things going on. Again, another set of practices I didn't really know. Mm-hmm. And I understood that the voice here that was dealing with international issues as well as state, local, national issues that I believed in, policy issues. I mean, it's policy. Agenda was the same as now's. It just wasn't, and even larger because it dealt with international issues. And I felt that its tone of voice was going to be more helpful to me than the tone of voice that I'd lived with all my life, and I was not enjoying in now. Because there were too many other people with the same tone of voice. And we're, yeah. I mean, it just wasn't working. So anyway, no question that my involvement that year in 1977 with first was the AAUW convention. Second was the meeting, the state meeting of the National Women's Conference that was held in Madison, where people came from all over the state. And I decided, somebody called me from Madison, somebody I knew, who had moved to Madison, called me and said, do you want to run to be a delegate? And I said, oh, what the hell, for this national conference in the fall. And my friends here in Eau Claire made T-shirts, which they put on, I think we were about four of us who went down together, and they all had red T-shirts that said, vote for Sarah Harder. Now, this was before anybody did T-shirts. Mm-hmm. And so, moving from this AAUW meeting, where I understood how things could run ideally, to this meeting in Madison, where there were women of every stripe and color, you know, all very interested in this creating this national plan of action. I met my dear friend and mentor Mary Lou Muntz there, and friends all these years. She was then in the legislature, and met other people, you know, whom I hadn't met before. And so and surprisingly, I got elected. Now, it's very clear the reason I got elected were the T-shirts, because nobody else had them. Uh-huh. And the fact, as a matter of fact, there was a judge who had just been nailed by the Women's Political Caucus because he made some nasty statements to a young woman in sentencing her in one of these usual misogynist spiels, and so he was out, and And so I remember walking through downtown Madison, and they said, "Who's Sarah Harder? Is she running for judge against this guy?" And anyway, it was funny. But the point is, I won. And so I went to the National Women's Conference, and I got involved very deeply in preparation for that with the other women who'd been in the delegation. I had to fly a lot. Mm. I flew that day. In those days, we had planes to Madison, planes to Milwaukee, and so forth. So, and I had to fly to Houston. And I first asked, is there any way I can take a bus? Because I was still not a happy flyer. And anyway, I went, and I got the role of floor manager in our delegation, which was hysterical because, of course, the only floor I'd ever been on was that one AAUW meeting where I was definitely a, you know, nowhere. But we were very deeply involved in what was called the Pro Plan Caucus that had been organized by AAUW nationally with other national women's organizations to say there's a right-wing Phyllis Schlafly effort, you know, to steal this thing. And we've got to organize because we know they're going to use maneuvers on the floor to try to gut some of the planks in the plan of action. So Wisconsin, because Kay Clarenbach, whom I knew now because she actually was doing this outreach to women leaders on different campuses and calling meetings for through UW Extension that John Morris let me go to and so forth. I mean, I had known these people. Kay Clarenbach was the executive director of the National Women's Conference, working with Bella Abzug, with whom she had been a co-founder of NOW. And anyway, because of that, we were in the absolute front of this very long and huge auditorium, and the Pro Plan Caucus had us signaling to the rest of the people behind us when an amendment that came to the floor was one that had been achieved by consensus off the floor by the women most affected, and therefore was approved as an amendment by the Pro Plan Caucus, as opposed to one that came from the right and should not be approved. Mm-hmm. And so there I was. I mean, I was up there signaling. You know, I got our delegation to vote. I convinced them. The big one there at this conference was, I think it was called then sexual orientation. Mm. And I, you know, I got our group, which was very much mixed ideologically, I got them to agree that even if they didn't support it, they wouldn't vote against it, they would just abstain. And so that when that one passed, it was great. When the one abortion, called reproductive choice, had passed, of course there was a big demonstration on the floor by the anti-choice groups, and my friends pushed me out there with a coat hanger placard and said, get in there, they're taking pictures. So there, you know, here were the TV cameras, and I was standing in the middle of this group, whoops.
I'm going to flip the tape here. If I can figure out how to. Okay, coat hanger.
Yeah, coat hanger. So here I was with this placard that says never again in the middle of all of these anti-abortion demonstrators. And standing there really feeling their passion, which I had to respect, at the same time I was doing this thing that was sort of so like me, you know, the skunk at the picnic. I got away with it. But then when we managed to get the sexual orientation thing passed, which, by the way, was preceded by pink balloons appearing in the galleries all around us, because not only were there something like 2,000 delegates, there were about 6,000 other people, and there were pink balloons that said, "We are everywhere." Mm-hmm. And it was awesome.
Yeah.
A word my granddaughter uses often and I use rarely, but it was awesome. So anyway, we got to the end of, and I was absolutely amazed by by the chairing of that thing, because the press had been saying it's going to be a cat fight. There's no way you can get all these women, who, most of whom have never been to a national conference before, to do anything. And they reduced it, of course, to the ERA, abortion and sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. That was the whole agenda. But, and why sexual orientation made it, I believe, was that a beautiful young Hispanic woman came to the mic and said, "You have passed the amendments to the minority women's plank that include me as a Hispanic woman. You have done this, you have done this, you know, how many?" And the last thing is that, you know, that I remain not accepted by our society is that I am a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this process of moving alphabetically from arts and humanities to welfare and poverty, and this process, which was terribly fair in bringing together off the floor women who felt that the five words that had been in the National Plan of Action just didn't do it, mm-hmm. And the consensus that was built, for instance, Gloria Steinem was the one who worked with minority women, so what became something started with there should be no prejudice or something about a minority women should have equal rights or something mm-hmm. like that. It, you know, had this magnificent platform that dealt with each of the separate groups that was read by them and introduced by Maya Angelou, and I mean it was an education unlike almost anything else. So anyway, we were moving to the last item in the National Plan of Action, which was to create a women's commission. And all of a sudden, I don't know how it happened, but Mary Lou Munce and I ended up in an inner sanctum room behind the podium Bella was chairing, where there was a huge struggle going on between feminists, including Ellie Smeal, who did not want a women's commission because they thought it was only going to be a women's department, I guess it was, women's department, because it was only going to be a pad for Bella. And a struggle between Bella, you know, wonderful Bella supporters like Brownie Ledbetter and others who said, you know, we're arguing for it. Look, you got to get beyond that and so forth. This thing, you know, when Gloria came in, I mean, all of the major players were in this little room. And it took probably 45 minutes. And there was agreement, finally. There was consensus about, yes, it could be, but I know there was going to be some amendment. We walked out, and the people on the floor were ready to riot. Because all through the whole process, they had been promised there were going to be time for amendments, you know, or for resolutions or something at the end of the process. And here was, you know, I don't know what they were doing, you know, da-dee-da-dee-da, you know, killing time is what they were doing. And so we came out with this, you know, and here I was, you know, ready to lead the troops to, yes, say that. And they were ready to riot. So, of course, they didn't pass that. Instead, they passed, there shall be a continuing committee of the conference that will da-da-da-da-da. So anyway, it was an enormous education for me. Mm-hmm. And back, going on the plane back, I sat with a woman who had been next to me in this abortion thing, and we had a very, very good discussion about what we believed could rationally be done to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And it seemed to me that there was enormous hope here. You know, here was a democratic process that wasn't supposed to work, but did work. And by respecting different segments of people and allowing them to lead in terms of the issues they knew best, mm-hmm. and confirming that we all supported those, mm-hmm. I mean, suddenly I saw, wow, this is really something. So I had at the AAUW convention, even though I didn't know anybody there, offered if there was any position on the state board of AAUW, I would be happy to serve. And that wasn't much likelihood of it, but suddenly somebody resigned, and so I was made the women's chair on the Wisconsin State Board of AAUW. And at that, slightly thereafter, I had been on the board maybe for two or three board meetings, yeah. And suddenly the national women's chair resigned. I had, in the meantime, been sending her articles that ended up going out, mm-hmm. you know, because I was now, you know, I was really into this. Mm-hmm. And so I got appointed to this position. By this time, I had never been the National Board of AAUW was a pretty big deal. And so anyway, I got appointed to the board, another window ledge position. But I should say also that we did go to bring the National Plan of Action to Jimmy Carter. And when I say we, I was appointed, again because of Kay, Clarenbach, and people who knew me, to the continuing committee of the National Women's Conference. And we all, you know, as many of us as could afford the fare, and John said, by all means, you have to go. John Morris said, you have to go. Went to the White House, and by this to deliver this to Jimmy Carter. But the meeting at the White House, which was in the early afternoon, was preceded by and followed by a meeting chaired by Bella Abzug, which was supposedly to figure out what this continuing committee of the National Women's Conference was going to do. And there were many people who. And again, I don't know how I ended up in a meeting, but it was a meeting of a whole bunch of people who said, now, you know, we can't let this just whip, you know, kind of whimper away. You know, Bella wants to have something, but we've got to make sure that this thing really lives. So where she was sort of planning on a thing where, you know, we'll now all sing yes, mm-hmm. you know, it was pretty clear that that this thing was going to be, just turning it all over to her was not going to, not going to be accepted. So what I was doing all this time was madly taking notes because I'm an inveterate. I mean, I learned to do it in college, and I just take very good notes. So at the end, they when we all went back after the lovely event at the White House, this meeting was going on into the night, and I had to call and get another airplane the next morning. One of my friends said, you can stay overnight with me. And so I changed my flight till the next morning so I could stay for it and keep taking notes. And what I was watching was a process leading to nowhere. Mm-hmm. Here were these 500 people appointed from every state in the union. And they elected a coordinating committee that represented Alaska, Maine, Florida, Southern California, you know, I mean, there was no way it was going to be functional. But anyway, you know, I recorded it, and after it was done, because I'd met Bronnie Ledbetter in this back room with Bella, I sent her a copy of the minutes I took, and I kept a copy. And there was an ERA march the following, I think it was probably the summer of 78, I'm not entirely sure of that, I think it was. Yeah, because February, I think it would have been the summer of 78. And Bella, because many of us were now asking what's going to happen with the National Women's Conference Committee, Bella called a meeting at the Department of Labor of those of us, and I don't remember how she got the word out. We had addresses of people. I guess it must have been by mail, because I mean, we didn't have anything else then. And anyway, I went with, and I went up to say hi to Brownie, and she said, oh, you're the person who took the minutes. And I said, yes, and so forth. So I sat down and started taking minutes again. And it came to the point where they were going to elect the secretary for the continuing committee. And I said, I'll be the secretary. You know, I put myself forward, and I was elected, partly again because I was from way in the hell out of anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly, you know, it was mostly the East Coasters duking it out to see, you know, who could move into these positions of great prominence. Well, I started running the National Women's Conference Committee out of my office at the university. I did it with the approval of John Morris and Larry Schnack and others. I mean, they said it's important that you do this. You're doing something historic. So what I had that nobody else had was access to copying facilities and a long-distance phone line that I could use. Now, I guess I should be careful about saying that because later I think the state legislature became very... they spent a lot of time ruining the reputations of faculty members and others who used their lines for personal purposes. Mm-hmm. But I was told I could do it, so I guess I wasn't doing anything so bad. But anyway... We then organized the first meeting of the National Women's Conference Committee in Madison, Wisconsin. I organized it with my friends down there, And we, wonderful women like Jean Boyer and Mary Lou Montz, Kay Clarenbach, and the whole UW Extension Women's Office. And so, I mean, everybody was helping to make it happen. We didn't know if anybody would come, but we ended up with, I think, about 300 of the 500 appointees turning up, and from everywhere, and including this amazing delegation of African American women, led by Dorothy Height, you know, and Bella Kane, of course, and the one of the co-chairs, woman from Iowa, whose name I'm blanking on at the moment, a wonderful legislator from Iowa, had resigned. She said, "I'll come to the meeting, but I just can't do this." Actually, she had lost her job in the legislature, probably for having been associated with this nefarious National Women's mm-hmm. Conference that was being used against a lot of people. Anyway, because I'd organized the meeting and somebody said, "Well, why don't you run for co-chair?" I did, mm-hmm. and I was elected. So then I was really running it out of my office, and within a couple of years then I was on, and next year I think I was on the AAUW thing. So I was working these two organizations together, trying to get AAUW to work on the National Plan of Action, because Carter had put it in the file cabinet. He appointed a commission on women with Bella Abzug and Carmen Vota as co-chairs, and then fired Bella when she and the commission dared to raise questions about his budget. Mm. And that was another big embroilment. Mm. And the person who was appointed to take her place was a woman who was then president of AAUW. I guess I may not have been on, no, I wouldn't have been on AAUW's board. It was probably after that. Probably wasn't until 1980 that I got appointed. But we published these National Plan of Action posters and held a big gig in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington to show the big poster with all of the articles of the National Plan of Action, and said, "We want, you know, we're not going to let it die." Mm-hmm. And Mary Grief, who was then the president of AAUW, came in support of this event, and she was the one, I guess, who appointed me then mm-hmm. shortly thereafter to the National Women's Conference, no, to the AAUW board. But then, as I said, I really began working the two organizations together and, well, for instance, got one of the major issues or programs of AAUW to be building advocacy networks, because as Lee Dreyfus fired the Kay Clarenbach's illustrious Commission on Women, we created the Wisconsin Women's Network, whose goal was to reinstate what became the Wisconsin Women's Council. Mm. And so there was, I don't even know where I was going with that. Where was I? You don't know.
So out of all of that, what would you say, is there one thing that you think would be like the most important thing that you did while you were involved? Can you pin it?
Yeah, I think it was to show the power of coalition building on a mm-hmm. multi-agenda inclusive, with inclusive participants, mm-hmm. diversity magna. Mm-hmm. And that is diversity that is built on basic bedrock principle of agreement. So, for instance, when I became the president of AAUW, I created a council of presidents, which had been started by my predecessor by meeting for lunch once a month with the heads of four organizations, but we made it real. It became the council of presidents. Mm-hmm. The premise that we used was the same premise we had used in the intervening years, because I was going to different places now being invited and helping to create state networks of women mm-hmm. using our Wisconsin Women's Network model, or what they had, you know, helping to transpose what they had. I think my biggest contribution was to present a set of bedrock principles on which you could decide who could be involved. And I got everybody to say, you can participate in this coalition whether or not you happen to be working for a particular issue in the National Plan of Action. But if your organization is formed to work against an issue in the National Plan of Action, Feminists for Life, mm. sorry. Yeah. the whole premise was of the National Women's Conference Committee is you had to work on the issues without priority. You had to be working on all of the issues, you know, and so forth, and be promoting the plan. Well, I found a way to use the plan, which is certainly cumbersome in its way. You know, it's a very big thing. I'll give you, later today, I'll give you a copy of this poster I talked about. And basically, but it became and is still used as a kind of credo by now what is now the National Council of Women's Organizations, that we welcome all comers, but if you're working against one of the major issues and this agenda, you're not welcome. I mean, we're just, you know, we're working, you know, we don't agree, and there are fundamental things we must agree on. Mm-hmm. And so through AAUW and the other link, you know, there was partly also this thing about using the agendas of others. So using the National Plan of Action and the premise of building networks, not only around the women who had been involved in those organizing meetings early in 1977, reaching back out, you know, saying that wasn't a one-time event, that was a commitment, let's keep this thing going, at a time when, you know, increasingly we're moving to a period where there was no support. I mean, we're moving rapidly into the Reagan administration, you know, at where it was perfectly clear that the not only was it put in a drawer, I mean, there was a deliberate undercutting of everything that we worked for. So it was paying very close attention to the directions being taken in policy and in public sentiment in the United States, and using those from, for instance, a national plan of action to choose five issues that had in common, first of all, the viability of the issue as something that could go. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not 20 years from now.
Right.
It's, you know, there's something in it we can move on. Mm-hmm. Critical need connected to it. So it's viability connected to critical need, connected to strong support among the organizations, each of which has its own issue, mm-hmm. and a potential for a distinctive contribution by this, you know, what these eventually became adopted by AAUW and were used still today to take what, when I first was elected as the legislative program chair after being appointed to the Women's Committee, we had a legislative agenda of 78 items, 78 priorities every year. Well, I mean, yeah, let's forget it.
Yeah.
But of course, there were people who would stand up, you know, at every convention, oh my God, we can't forget the whales, you know, which I don't want to forget either.
Right.
But so anyway, it was saying that we can sustain the connection to the whole, which we must. Mm-hmm. We must sustain the connection to the whole. At the same time, we use the capacity of that whole to demonstrate that what might seem to be a marginal issue is in fact not marginal at all. Mm-hmm. It represents the whole spectrum, standing up with females. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the strategy of continuing to use very pointed public education, you know, figuring out first of all what are the priorities that really have a chance here, and then figuring out, okay, who are the people we want to be, you know, our partners on each of these, mm-hmm. and making sure that all of those had a representation that looked like America.
Right.
I think that was it.
Yeah, that's huge. Just organizing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then I did, you know, my first trip abroad was 1980 to the World Conference in Copenhagen, which was another, you know, mm-hmm. full university degree in 2 weeks, where suddenly, I mean, not only was I conscious of the Ayatollah Khomeini hanging on the corridors and the flocks of black hooded women who were being herded by men, you know, around this thing, came to know about genital mutilation, which I'd never known about, but perhaps more importantly, came to understand fundamentally that wood and water were a woman's issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understood very solidly that that to a certain extent, our Western women's agenda was an agenda of privilege. Mm-hmm. And that if we didn't address fundamentally education, which had offered me my access to anywhere, mm-hmm. and voices, and, you know, all of these other things, unless we trusted the credibility of people who had experienced these things to define the issue and to help us determine what should be a strategy that will work for them, and how we cannot, for instance, one of the things I saw at Copenhagen was a whole bunch of Western women like me who'd spotted genital mutilation saying, "Oh God, we're going on our white horses now, and we're going to save African women from this terrible thing." Crap! I know. Yeah. I mean, no. Fortunately, I also met women, a wonderful woman from England who became my very dear friend, Scylla Elworthy, who later on we moved into issues of peace building, nuclear disarmament, and other things together. And she's doing wonderful things in the world, having created a group called the Elders, which you sometimes hear about in news stories. For instance, when they were thrown out of Somalia. Because Jimmy Carter dared to say, "Listen, you guys, you're blowing it. You got to do it." No, it wasn't. It was Zimbabwe. Mm. Zimbabwe. I mean, it's a group that I sort of helped her advise her on, where she was picking. She wanted to make sure there were an equal number of women in this group of elders, leaders, you know, established leaders whose voices would be credible in dealing with major conflict issues in the world.
So going off of kind of, you know, extending into the globalization issue and just trying to encompass it as an entire women's movement and not the Western women's movement, what do you kind of consider one of the most important challenges of feminism in this century or in this immediate time frame?
Well,
I'm sorry, I think it stopped. Let me rephrase that. What do you consider the most important challenge of feminism to overcome in this century?
Well, I think we have to look at fundamental issues. Mm-hmm. I think we have to look at conflict, and that's, I suppose, how I finally got to where I am in the National Peace Foundation. I don't work less on women's issues, and I don't work less with women than I did in the women's movement. Mm-hmm. It's just that I work on issues that involve men too, and I always engage men too, and they are issues that take that critical need part and raise it up, because in conflict we know that women are and children are the first oppressed and violated and destroyed by war. It's not armies. Mm-hmm. Violence is certainly a key issue. Beyond that, education. And one of the issues I brought into AAUW was girls, working for girls, and that fundamentally led to the AAUW report, Shortchanging Girls, Shortchanging America, and how American schools shortchange girls. Those were absolutely mine. I mean, they came from my little women's committee in AAUW, and they moved. I carried them forward when I was president, and it was a big jump for AAUW to think about girls as a serious agenda item. Mm-hmm.
I noticed that you wrote a speech at the Adolescent Pregnant conference or something, talking about teen pregnancy.
Mm.
You were talking about teen pregnancy, and I noticed you said that in all of the things I wanted to change was teaching men how to be more responsible, or teaching, you know, always involved men and not women. And you talked about how a lot of girls had like a learned helplessness because they didn't, you know, you talked about this earlier too. So do you think we've progressed from that?
Yeah, we've made some progress. The Choices conferences that we started here at UW Eau Claire and have spread all over the country. It was part of our, you know, I guess maybe not part of our women's studies program. It was part of what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things is also, I think if there's another really important point, and I'm going to get back to the academy now, that the biggest problem created by the 20th century was specialization. It was also the thing that allowed us to leap forward in so many areas. Unfortunately, all the major problems of the 21st century, very few of them can be solved by those specialists. They are all multidisciplinary issues. They are all multisectoral issues. And that, again, that goes back to my point about having to pull together a base of knowledge and experience and to listen as we begin to understand what's the fundamental core of problems and resistance to change, and what and how we can synthesize from the knowledge, the respective knowledges we bring to the table, how we can synthesize a constructive, creative, absolutely new way to address the issue and find a solution. Engage, which always involves engaging as many people as possible. So as far as I'm concerned, that the issue, just as in the women's movement and in other organizing, it was single issue campaigns that the 20th century created. Mm-hmm. Well, now we see the standoff in, for instance, reproductive choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no bridging ground, and unless you can get the bridge, you're always fighting against a brick wall. It may be a smaller brick wall than it once was, but the fact is, it's still a brick wall.
What would the bridge look like? I mean, how would you attain that? You know,
I think one thing is to see how things have become. If a movement or a discipline is always facing only attack from out there, they tend to go deeper and deeper and deeper into finding more rationalizations for standing pat. Mm-hmm. And I think it's always going to mean, where can we move? What goes back to viability, mm-hmm. critical need, mm-hmm. strong support, a sort of baseline support from a lot of people to any proposal that came forward. And then creating distinctive contributions by the group, you know, making everybody have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so there's a distinct, you know, everybody not only puts in but gets something mm-hmm. from what's coming out. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm doing now in the National Peace Foundation. I mean, we're moving on health, what we're calling health diplomacy, but basically it's using healthcare as a means of undercutting conflict. So, for instance, a program I'm working with a colleague in the state of Washington. I've worked with this woman for 20 years in trying to get this thing going. I think we might finally do it this year. She has created what she calls the Mamas Program, which uses maternal and child health with the most dispossessed, maternal and child health with appropriate technology to bring the best kind of medical resources to the life and death issue of mothers and children, as a way of building a base of public support mm-hmm. and undercutting all the naysayers. We're looking at bringing a new technology that has not been used by our Army Corps of Engineers and has now been privatized, although it was created by the Army Corps of Engineers, of gasification of refuse of all kinds. So it means it doesn't have to be separated. It's gasification process that produces energy, water, and a usable small pelleted residue to create electricity. I mean, to remove the challenge to the groundwater, to provide plants that can be neighborhood based, and therefore, I mean, not a grid that can be bombed by somebody or something else. It is engagement of the what and empowerment of the broadest segment of our population. Mm. I mean, that's what I use that term, feminization of power, which I really created. It was in my contradiction to the feminization of poverty, which was, the sort of in term at the time I created it, because, of course, we understood that, now that we had data from the women's movement and women's policy centers, we understood the extent to which poverty was a women's condition. But I hated the word because it sort of says, there it is, and we're all just kind of mm-hmm. getting povertized or mm-hmm. something, And so I created the feminization of power to make a basic distinction in what is power. There's a male power that excludes, mm-hmm. or imposes. But that's not the power I'm talking about. It's not, I mean, because the more we exclude and the more we impose, the more greater likelihood there is, I mean, not only of creating great injustice, but also of blow up, finally blow up in response. But feminine, as far as I'm concerned, feminine power has to do with inclusion. It has to do with inclusion with the understanding that the more you bring together, the more energy you create. It's like rural electrification, or it's like photosynthesis in plants. If you can keep the conditions right, what you do is get, you know, you can get more people together. If you're thinking, if you really respect them, if you're really dealing, you know, with the issues that they that are fundamental to their lives, that can happen. Now, I also understood that that term was far more threatening than feminization of poverty, because feminization of poverty, of course, puts women right in the place, you know, right in their place. And feminization of power, of course, feminism, you know, the presumption of, you know, what we're going to do is come out with, you know, the male model, battles, you know, power, banging, you know, all of that stuff. And that feminism doesn't include men, which is absolute nonsense. But some of the best feminists in my life, some of the feminists who've made the greatest difference in what I've been able to do have been men, no question. So it's misunderstanding of feminization. What does that mean? Because they're calling it a separation, and I'm calling it a bringing together. And power, which is seen as, again, this very negative thing. That it's not...
When
it's
in a woman's hands.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary. What in the hell is... What does broad got in mind, you know? And... But I do believe in it, and I've worked for it. You know, I've sort of worked for it in many different ways. And I suppose if you were going to ask what the fundamental thing I have worked for, and I am working for, it is progressive change. I first understood that progressive change could take place when the UW system changed a policy that excluded women from doing what they need to do when they have kids. So I'm always looking, and I suppose if there's been a discipline in my life that I have studied, although not formally, it is change. Mm-hmm. What promotes it? What extends it? What leads first to sustainability of a change in a small pilot project and can lead to institutionalization of change in a whole fleet of domestic violence projects across the United States, and where do we hit the paradigm shift, which finally, you know, somehow or other gets to the deal of educating men to see that it's not something that they can do or should do or want to do. You know, we haven't reached that yet, but I mean, those are the stages I see, and I'm always examining what are the barriers, what are the ways around the barriers. If we can't get to that out there, let's never lose sight of that. But let's not say, I'm not going to play if you're not working for that. Mm-hmm. Let's say, let's figure out that if we get this, and we show we can succeed, and can bring more and more people in on board, and show more and more people that it's not threatening, mm-hmm. we can then go here. Mm-hmm. And again, we're building public opinion, we're building you know, participants, we're building... people's change in people's own lives. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
so
definitely.
So that's it.
Wow. Okay, switching to particularly UW-Eau Claire now, and just have like this last 10 set of questions or so. Might be a little preview of what she went over earlier.
I'm going to go to the toilet.
Okay.
So turn off the and if you would like some more tea?
I would have a little bit more, yeah.
It's very cool.